Thank you for tuning in to the Head Game Podcast, powered by Mindful Athlete Training, where you grab an inside look into the heads and minds of the high performer. Learn what they do and how they think to help you take control of your own head game.
Welcome to another episode of the Head Game. Today's guest is Michael Seeley, a licensed psychotherapist and mental performance coach. He helps his clients view challenges as opportunities for growth so they can take consistent, positive actions to improve their lives. Early in life, Michael found competitive cycling as an opportunity to push his limits. He competed at an elite level, achieving 2 state titles and multiple trips to the Olympic trials. Following his competitive career, he became a teacher, and it was there that he recognized that he had more to give by inspiring others to also achieve their best selves. He has since founded Michael Seeley Mental Coaching and Seeley Counseling. He is also the founder of Men's Therapy Directory, a website dedicated to helping men access counseling resources. Michael shares his story and valuable insights into his journey into helping others and techniques on how to become your best self. Enjoy another look into the Head Game.
Well, Michael Seeley, welcome to the Head Game.
Thanks, great to be here.
So I understand you're from Naples, Florida, and you had a little bit of a cold snap, you said, just a few moments ago. Talk to us a little bit about your journey of how you found your way to Florida, your perspective as a mindset coach, some of your background, just so our listening audience can really kind of get a more intimate snap of who you are and what you do.
Yeah, well, I grew up in Wisconsin, near Madison, Wisconsin, a small farm town called Barneveld, Wisconsin, a little town. And
we'll have to allocate another full hour, Michael, to discuss Aaron Rodgers.
Okay.
I'm just throwing that out there.
Yeah, we can definitely
If you're a homegrown Wisconsin native, I mean, he just came out of some silence, darkness retreat. So
right.
I definitely want your take on that. So let's circle back. Wisconsin, Cheesehead, Rodgers.
For sure, sure. A lot to talk about with Aaron Rodgers, for sure.
Oh, yeah.
That said, I am a dyed-in-the-wool Wisconsin fan of sports, Milwaukee Bucks, Green Bay Packers, Milwaukee Brewers, of course, huge fan of them. But yeah, I grew up in Wisconsin, really into athletics at an early age, played Little League Baseball, did like all sports I could, just really loved sports. And the thing that really bit me, that really got me, was bicycle racing. I didn't even really know that it existed. And I randomly walked into a movie theater in Madison, Wisconsin, and saw this movie called Breaking Away, which came out in 1980. It's kind of a sleeper film. It's really good. Won a couple Academy Awards.
I'm kind of an 80s sleeper kind of guy.
Yeah.
Right. Talk to me more. That sounds familiar. Yeah. Who's in that?
Dennis Quaid is in it. He's kind of like the big star. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
But it's a great,
right?
It's a great story about like a small town teenager who discovers bike racing. And I totally like related to that. And I didn't even know that really road bike racing existed. It's a great movie. So I walked out of the theater. It's like, that's what I'm doing for the rest of my life. And that's
it.
Really, that movie was the catalyst.
Right there.
Right there, yeah. So I started.
I love that.
Yeah, I started racing right away. I traveled around the country, you know, basically barely finished high school because I was traveling all the time across the country racing. And then I made the big decision not to go to college and really pursue bike racing professionally. Did that till about age 24, 25. And kind of peaked out. I got a lot of, you know, hindsight 2020 on that. I could tell you all about that. I think I could have gone a little longer. But point being, I kind of burned out, maxed out, and went to college. Became a high school Spanish teacher for a couple of years. Really enjoyed that. Hardest job I ever loved. basically, really, really tough. Great job. But then I realized I wanted to get more into one-on-one. I really enjoyed working with kids one-on-one, especially underperforming kids who were getting like D's and F's that I knew were really, really capable, and coached a number of those kids into getting some really good grades. And that was super satisfying. So I went to grad school, got a master's degree in counseling psychology, and basically never looked back. So right now what I do is 50% is probably psychotherapy, just working with quote unquote normal people on normal issues. And the other 50% is working with athletes, either from a reparative standpoint. The athlete will come to see me kind of debilitated by anxiety or slump or something like that. And then some athletes just on the performance spectrum who are doing quite well and just want to up level. So that's my story, basically how I got into it.
So you lead me off right to a question that I need to ask much sooner than later. Dr. Stevens and I just last night did an educational seminar for parents of student athletes. And we led off, Michael, with a bit of a mental warm-up where we highlighted the $10 million gift to the Olympic Committee by a family foundation to aid the athletes in mental health services. And we were trying to distinguish the difference that while mental health is crucial to the development and the support of athletes, it's still a reactionary process whereby the onus falls on the shoulders of the athletes to go get themselves help. And you're telling me you're doing 50-50. So what better an expert do we need to ask? What's your different mindset with the 1%ers that we call them, the high performers trying to get better, trying to develop their craft versus the someone who is just struggling or is more of reacting to something in their life that they know they need to work on?
Yeah, the difference being that typically the athletes who come to see me with either some sort of anxiety or burnout have waited too long. They haven't taken a proactive approach, or they haven't had the benefit of like a really good coach. There's a lot of factors that get the athlete to that point of kind of desperation, of kind of broken down, needing some repair work. But generally speaking, I think it's, not reaching out soon enough for help. So athlete that sees me for wanting to just, improve their performance and they're functioning quite well, realizes that in order to get to the next level, I'm going to need to up my mental game. I need to tap into something else just besides training to get that next level. So those athletes, maybe have some more awareness about the benefits of mental coaching or psychology, and they buy into it. Whereas some of the other athletes who maybe wait too long, there may be some stigma around it. Like, I'm not crazy. There's nothing wrong with me. I'm going to tough it out. That inner toughness, resilience can be a useful tool, and it can also kind of backfire on you too if you think you're so strong that you don't need any coaching. I mean, we know all the great athletes ever had coaches. All of them did. And, I think just being aware, being able to buy into the mental aspect of sports is huge. And I think what we need to do is just, have podcasts like this where we raise the awareness and talk about how important it is. And then it becomes a discussion, a proactive discussion, as opposed to a reactive response, right?
Yeah. It's so interesting because, when you're an athlete, you focus so much on building strength for performance in a proactive way, but also the secondary approach of when you do strength training, when you do endurance training, when you do stamina building, it's also that preventative effect too, right? It's going to reduce levels of injury, right? There's tons of research on, athletes who are performing because of the strength training have kind of reduced the level of injury likelihood. And it's so interesting that people don't necessarily see the analogous kind of back-to-back nature of the same with the mental, right? That mental training, giving you the resources, giving you the tools, is both the strength building aspect of it, as well as the mental injury prevention, right? That comes with it. And so many great athletes now have had to pull themselves out of their sport, the things that they love, the things that got to them to the top of the position. And what's really interesting is the narratives that surround those athletes who have to pull themselves out. Comparatively to maybe some athletes who have been open about talking about it and are training it actively and just letting people know, there's almost like also more of a buffer if they do have to pull themselves out or if something is challenging them, then it's just an athlete who has to pull themselves out immediately. So that proactive strategy also, I think, helps navigate the narrative surrounding the mental, more so than just even the actual athlete having to do something about it.
Yeah, it is really that narrative of getting people talking about it more. It makes me think of two examples. One is Steve Young, the former 49ers quarterback. I don't know if you know his story, but he wrote this book about his debilitating anxiety he suffered from throughout his career. He waited a long time to disclose this. And really interesting story. And the other example would be someone like Michael Phelps, who is like very, very open and talks about it a lot and has gotten a lot of psychotherapy himself and has benefited from it and is completely transparent about it. And in the case of Steve Young, it's a really incredible story. There's actually this, I think if you Google NPR Steve Young anxiety, it pops up this particular podcast. And he talks about how his anxiety was so bad when he was playing for the 49ers, and he was a great quarterback. His anxiety was so bad, he would be up for like a couple days straight and he couldn't eat. And he was like dry heaving and vomiting and would be like shaking and like, and then game time, he would get into the zone, he would snap in, but he had this such performance anxiety. And if he would have gotten help earlier, I mean, he could have been probably even better. He did eventually get help, but that gets me thinking about that sort of reactive strategy versus proactive, and how as each year goes by, we're talking more and more about mental health, just in general for the, you know, quote unquote, normal people, and also for athletes. Also, you saw like in the Summer Olympics with Simone Biles, you remember the gymnast?
Yes.
She dropped out, and there was a lot of commentary about that. It was interesting how people commented with empathy or with kind of disdain. So there's clearly a lot more work we need to do in educating people. And I think it's really just a lot of education.
Yeah, I think, you know, just kind of jumping off that too, you know, the narratives around those conversations, especially with Simone, like, I think what she had to do was the right choice, right? She had to do that for her own safety and where she was at in that moment. And it's more so if there's a, maybe even more of like, hey, she's been working with somebody, she's been training with somebody, and they just haven't really kind of found the right protocol for her to kind of maximize it. That narrative is like, oh, well, that makes sense. Like, but again, this kind of mental kind of conversation always becomes vague. It's much more kind of hush hush versus like, yeah, this athlete's been rehabbing for the past year and a half and they're not quite to 100% yet. Right. And here's why. Here are some of the reasons why. Like having that active conversation, and almost, I think with mental, there's a vulnerability aspect to it because there's a lot of personality. And obviously, like with like physical and stuff like that, there's the HIPAA laws and all those things. So there's some protection on that end. But I think with the mental, there's this vulnerability aspect that people are insecure sometimes to have those open discussions and not to put themselves out there because they feel like that's going to put them on the back front. And a lot of psychologists and therapists kind of still have that mentality too when they're talking with clients and patients. And then in the sports world, because it's such on a stage and people are, you know, you think just because somebody's performing well that their mental is in the right place, that doesn't necessarily always go hand in hand. You know, Steve Young is checking in, he's getting into a different zone, but that doesn't necessarily mean, you know, he's in the right place. Tiger Woods, right, is competing at a very high level, but clearly not necessarily completely, you know, people say he's one of the most mentally strong individuals. I think it's based on the circumstance where he shows mental strength. So it's really about understanding, you know, that narrative that kind of surrounds it. And Lee, I kind of jumped and cut you off real quick.
It was something absolutely brilliant. And now it's gone forever because I was so wrapped into what you were saying, Hunter, that it slowly but surely just, you know, dropped down on the hierarchy scale. What I was going to ask Michael is, you know, in your own work, Michael, you talk about, you speak about challenges specifically as opportunities for growth. So I have two questions. The first is, what do you consider to be your greatest challenge? And then when you recognize a challenge in an athlete that you're working with, how do you bring that into the forefront?
Yeah, sure. So my biggest challenge, I would say, is probably something that's plagued me like most of my life. And that is this kind of trepidation about going to the next level, whatever that level is. And there's always the next level up. Breaking time records in sports, whatever it is, like you can always hit a higher level. And for me, I've come to a couple of plateaus. And this is what I work with my athletes too, is this sort of this plateauing out where you accomplish something, you've really achieved a lot, and you kind of rest on your laurels and that you get comfortable in that zone. And then the challenge for me is like, okay, well, why am I afraid of going to the next level? And there's a lot of really subtle factors involved in that. And that's for me, is to kind of push myself to that next level. And not that you can celebrate your victories, of course, but growing just feels good. Like if you're stagnant, it's boring. So I'm always trying to push myself to get to the next level in a lot of different things. So for the athletes I work with, it is a lot of times their challenge as well is this getting to that next level. they can get comfortable at a certain level. And there's also something of this sort of fear of success, which is a really interesting thing to talk about. And it has a lot to do like with your peer group, so that athletes may actually be afraid of losing their friends and losing their family by getting to the next level. Because it's like the expectation, we basically thrive in peer groups where our expectations are similar. That's where we thrive the most. So if an athlete is like a superstar and they don't want to leave their hometown or don't want to, you know, disappoint their parents who want them to be a lawyer, like that's going to be this sort of background psychological trip that's going to keep them from leveling up. So when I work with athletes, I ask them like, well, what are you afraid of? Right? Let's dig into the deepest fears. And often it comes down to like, I'm afraid of my parents' approval or disapproval. And that's still a huge thing for athletes, even like in their late 20s, early 30s. So it's, leveling up is a really interesting process. It's, of course, has to do with talent, has to do with coaching, but there's certain levels where it is just mental and you need to face that fear and dive right into it.
That has such mental depth to what you're saying of conversation and different directions that we can take it. Specifically, the athlete's point of view and their perspective that they're letting other people down or they're disappointing. You know, there's always the epicenter I like to talk about is fear. And that's really the radio signal. And then there are all these individual satellites in which the fear signal can fear of failure, fear of rejection, fear of not being fully accepted in your peer group, fear of the unknown specifically. And to your point, I think every professional, athlete or not, can relate to the statement that you just made, Michael, of getting to that point of comfort. You know, from Philadelphia, anytime I have the opportunity to say, hungry dogs run faster, is, you know, what we what was our big mantra of our offensive line when we won the Super Bowl. And once you fill the fridge and you get comfortable and you get riddled with satiety, you're not as hungry. And that's a human nature thing. Right, the whole concept of fasting is to activate more of a survival instinct, because when our body is deprived of food longer, it starts to produce all of these wonderful neurochemicals in our body that help us live longer and create more physical and psychological resiliency. So I guess my follow-up to that is, and take it any direction that you like, but when this leveling up process that you speak kind of presents itself when you're working with a client, what are your preferences of where you like to take them? Or what are the strategies or techniques that you find the most effective, Michael, in your work?
Yeah, so it's like a two-pronged approach. I want to get them intellectually just understanding, like basically what we're talking about, their self-awareness. Like, here's the dynamics. Here's maybe why you're having this fear or trepidation about leveling up. And when they get that, then it actually does make sense. Like, oh, right, that's true. Like, I'm afraid of losing my friends at my, you know, my level right now, like they're going to judge me. Or if I get to the next level, I'm going to be judged and not accepted, and I'll be banished from both tribes. Like, that's kind of irrational, but it is like this primal fear. It's kind of how we're wired. We're social creatures. So it's a lot of education and self-awareness with the athlete I'll work with. And when it makes sense, then I'll go, okay, it's time to step, you know, jump in the cold water. Let's try an experiment. Let's not like throw you in the deep end, but what's one thing you can do that would be really uncomfortable for you? And it might just simply be like networking with a higher level athlete, like reaching out to them and connecting with them. Something that just kind of like, oh, that's scary. Like, I'm not good enough for that. Or it could be entering a race where you don't think you're prepared for, or doing a new workout that's going to challenge you. But just something where it's a test or experiment of, let me tap into that next level and get a taste of it. Now that I understand the dynamics of, you know, fear of failure, fear of success, let me try that experiment. And Michael, I'm going to give you some feedback on how that went for me. And so it's, you know, half cognitive, half behavioral. And then we do a couple more experiments. And then finally, like, they went, hey, you know, I like jumping in the cold water. That's fun. And then they ask me for more, or they have an idea about, yeah, I want to reach out to this team and I want to, you know, connect with them. So it's kind of like massaging the cognitive and the behavioral to get them prepped for leveling up.
High performers are constantly doing a risk analysis, you know, whether that's on the field or court, right? Should I make this play? Should I not make this play? But also off the field as well, or court. And you know, should I make this or not? And, you know, what you're talking about is really taking risks, trying to do calculated risk, but that trial and error kind of process. And, you know, something that we regularly talk about is we call them base camps. So base camps is, you know, if you're climbing up Mount Everest, there's, you know, a variety of base camps as you get higher and higher up the mountain. And as you get closer to, you know, that 10,000, 15,000 foot level, oxygen starts to decrease and your body needs to acclimatize, needs to assimilate, get used to that high level altitude. So you can't just jump straight up. Now, you know, people who are the Sherpas and then the Nepalese, you know, out there, they can kind of figure it out and their bodies are accustomed to it. But maybe more Westerners who kind of travel out there to do the climb, they need more time to adjust. And so they're spending a lot more time on the mountain. And so going from a base camp 3 to a base camp 4, you can't just go 3 to 4. You have to kind of climb like from base camp 3 to kind of climb your way up a little bit, come back down, climb your way up a little bit, come back down. And then you can finally make that jump from 3 to 4. And what base camp really serves as, it serves as a resource point, a gathering point, a resting point to kind of take your leap from. But a lot of people, when they're taking risks, they feel like, well, I didn't get from base camp 3 to 4. That's a failure. But really what's happening to those bodies as you go halfway up is there's still acclimatization. Your body is still getting adjusted. And it's when people take risks, it's the same thing that's happening for them. They might not always succeed in getting to that next step that they want to, but that doesn't mean they haven't learned. That means their body doesn't mean that their body hasn't adjusted. So we like to call those base camps of like those safe resource built places that you can take leap from, can jump into the cold waters, see what that feels like. And sometimes, you know, sports psychologists can be that for people, right? Kind of be those base camps to kind of come back and reassess. Sometimes teammates, environments. So it really depends on what that structure looks like. But sometimes as athletes, you have to create that yourself or find those places to go from. But I'm in agreement with you, absolutely, that those are necessary to kind of experiment and play with a little bit to take those risks from to really get to that next level.
Yeah, I love that analogy. I mean, the base camp, like you say, is typically, it is a coach that you can trust or a teammate that you can trust and be vulnerable with and say, hey, you know, I'm afraid of doing this. What do you think? Like, oh, dude, you should totally go for it. So that is that base camp where you just feel like this safety place, right? And a place of encouragement as well and nourishment. And so that I think that said, like having a great coach is important. Having great supportive teammates is super important. And athletes that don't have that and they're just on their own, like that's where you can kind of get lost in the weeds. And, you know, I look back on my cycling career, I was always reluctant to get a coach. And that was like, I think, a really big mistake. I had a couple of folks, it's like teammates, other cyclists who were like my base camp, but it wasn't for a long period of time. And I think it's super important to have that coach or somebody in your life where you can just really
trust. Was that learning curve for you? What did you need to, I guess, recognize to be like, okay, like a coach would be necessary? Or, you know, looking back, was it, you know, what clicked for you where you recognized that that's something of value that I could have had sooner, but now that I recognize it, I need to implement it? Like, what was that learning curve for you that you needed to go through as kind of a young aspiring professional?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, I don't think I really saw that until I quit cycling. It was like a couple of years later where I was working with you know, kids in high school and helping them improve their grades, where it was like, oh man, I wish I would have had me, you know, back then. And you know, one of my strengths was I'm very motivated and very determined, very strong-willed, and I think that was kind of the problem is that I was not reaching out to enough people. Like when I was feeling a little bit of burnout, I was in denial. And we all know like athletes love denial. So, hey, nothing's wrong with me, right? And so it was that the strength that became kind of a weakness. Like I'm just going to push through this burnout. It'll be fine. I need to figure it out in my head. There's something wrong with me. You know, like I got to push through this. And if I would have had that coach or would have reached out, that would have been so helpful. I could have gotten that perspective. Coach could have told me like, this happens to everybody. You're not alone. And would have provided that proverbial base camp for me. But for me, it was more of like someone would come into my life like every year and a half and encourage me. And that would be my base camp. But I was much more independent. And that was kind of the weakness there, just being kind of too independent.
Michael, I'm listening to you, and I recall you mentioning earlier when you chose not to go to college, you really jumped into full-on aspiration of making cycling your life. And so often, in my experience, one of the things that we try to emphasize with athletes is if you're going to walk it, you need to talk it first, but the follow-through is really where all of the learning comes from. But in many instances, we're asking athletes to do things that we ourselves have not done. But in your case, you said, you know what? I'm going to take some risks here. I'm going to bathe in discomfort. I'm going to jump not only in the cold water, but in the deep end. Talk to us a little bit about your mindset in making that decision to do what you did. And then what have you learned from it that you now put into your craft?
Yeah, it was really, I'll be honest with you. It was, I want to thank a therapist that I had when I was 15 years old. So this is part of my story too. A seed was planted when I was 15. My parents were getting divorced and they sent me to therapy. I was kind of, you know, acting out, getting in trouble in class and say, hey, fix this kid. And fortunately, I had just a really, really good therapist. His name was Gary. And I was just starting to get really good at bike racing. And I remember there was a particular session that we had. And I had just gotten a pretty good result in a race. It was like ninth place in this really big race. And I was telling him the story, and I was waiting for some nice approval from him. And he just kind of mockingly clapped at me and went, good job, fantastic. So a pretty provocative technique to work with a teenager, but we had enough rapport that worked with me. And what his strategy was he was noticing that I was afraid of success, and that he was like, well, why didn't you win? Right. And that's when we had enough rapport, he really started pushing me in this direction of, you know, go for it, jump in that deep end of the pool. And shortly thereafter, I had probably my best result ever. I'd pushed myself like way more than I'd ever pushed myself in a race. And again, it was like we get back to that base camp of that coach where there was a safety and transparency. And he's like, he recognized what I needed to hear. It was this kind of this tough love. So that was really, that's a big part of my story where I got to where I am today in this field of having somebody like that. But you know, sometimes some of the best coaches are coaches who have quote unquote failed. And like when I look at, you know, stopping my cycling career, deciding to go to college, and I went through that whole burnout thing and that whole thing of thinking I can do it all myself, that is a huge teachable lesson to other people, right? And sometimes athletes who don't go through that, who have like the picture storybook career, they don't have enough adversity in there to recognize those traps in other athletes. So that's a little story for you.
I think of Mike Singletary's inability to take it to the professional coaching level, being a Hall of Fame linebacker. You know, so often we hear just because you can play doesn't mean you can coach. To your point of having so much success in your repertoire, on your resume, doesn't always translate to your ability to communicate that or to take that to the next level. Without getting too much into a deep dive or ruining for all of our fans if they want to go out and watch the film Breaking Away, there are parts of that movie that almost sound like some of your biography, Michael, of what you went through when you were younger or meeting the right person or being pushed by the right individual and sort of breaking away from that scenario with, you know, the discomfort of your parents' separation.
Yeah, it is a nice side-by-side comparison. And, you know, the title of the film, Breaking Away, is a triple entendre or something, all the different levels to it. But yeah, that's really the metaphor, right? Of like, it's kind of like the hero's journey too. If you think about that, of, you know, you're coming of age, you're 18, 19, and you go outside of your town and you explore the world and things like that. And so that was something that I really wanted to do. I was a big fan of Star Wars, the movie when it came out in the late 70s, a similar type of journey, really, you know, adversity, going to the next level, hero's journey, all that stuff. So that when I was 18, I couldn't wait to move, and I just pursued bike racing completely. I did jumped in the deep end. I did this race in Texas at the time. It was called the Tour of Texas, and I was I think I was 19, and it was some of the best professionals in the entire world of cycling, and I was way out of my league, and you know, like barely finishing the races, and you know, racing with my heroes and all these superstars. And by the time I finished that, I had totally up-leveled. And I think not just in fitness, but in being comfortable with racing with the best cyclists in the world. Like, yeah, they're just people. You know, I think a lot of sports performance does revolve around just social approval and peer groups, and that, you know, wanting to be recognized and wanting to be liked and wanting to fit in. That's a huge, huge part of it. And, you know, like fear of success and fear of failure really comes a lot from, what are other people going to think of me? Am I going to be embarrassed? Will people accept me? Will they think I'm a loser? All these things, it comes into play big time. And I think it's not talked about enough.
So many athletes can go through their entire career, Michael, and not engage in that data capture that you just articulated so specifically of, you know what, they're just people too. And I think there's so much more in that statement for the high-performing mindset individual out there that's listening, where they're just, you know, they're putting their pants on one leg at a time, the same way that everyone else does. But there's so, I think social media specifically and the saturation of achievement and success and the way everything is time captured, especially for younger athletes that are constantly looking at success, 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 we quickly start to separate ourselves. We put those performers in a different category because it's safer. Yeah. It's safer to put them there because now there's less of a direct comparison. There's less of a reflection process. There's less self-judgment. And what happens because of that is the attainment of those goals becomes farther and farther away. It becomes more of that far off distant ideal. And we stop focusing on the realized self, that if they put one foot in front of the other, as our good friend Chris Schmidt from Azimuth Consulting, which led us to the mountains of Montana this past summer, his mantra is put one foot in front of the other. Get your eyes on the horizon line, and you can always do more than you think you can by simply putting one foot in front of the other. It's really how we came to find our own perceived ceiling of mental capacity in what we are pursuing in our own path of what it is to be mentally fit. What are some things, Michael, that you do personally to seek mental fitness and then convey that to your clients?
Yeah, one big thing is just simply non-negotiable routines. That's a big one right there. So if you have, you know, like a morning routine, I'm big on morning routines of priming yourself so that, you know, we have state psychology and trait, state and trait. So like some people may be morning people. I'm not one of them. And I know that I could forever try to think my way into being a morning person, but it's not going to happen. It's not my trait, but the state, I can change my state. Keeping that mental sharpness and toughness is some routines that you subscribe to and is non-negotiable. So for me, I do a gratitude journal every morning, and I prime myself, have my cup of coffee, and I write down what I'm grateful for. And some mornings I'm like, this is stupid, I'm not into this. But by the time I do it, it's like, yeah, it was cool. And then that'll build and build and build. And it starts that the routine itself is on autopilot, and I just do it. Or there's like a bedtime during the week. Like I'm always in bed at this particular time. So some real basic stuff like that for the athletes I work with is like, what are your daily routines? What is it? What is it that you do? Is there a time where you like to worry during the day? Worry about your next race? Can you actually, and this is kind of counterintuitive, can you have a worry journal where you say to yourself, I don't worry until it's worry journal time? And so like at, you know, 6 p.m., I write down 15 minutes and I set my timer and I just write down worries. And that compartmentalizes the worrying. So there's some certain like rituals you can do during the day that just keep you sharp, Right. Now, if you want to get even sharper, if you really want to file the edges, that again goes down to those experiments where you challenge yourself. Like, what is it that you want to do, you know, this week? What, one thing to challenge yourself. And a lot of times it's reaching out and doing social networking with people, with someone that that you want to connect with. Like, I'm big on having athletes focus on their career while they're in their career. Like, how are you going to use this as a springboard, you know, help after your sport? And so that I'll give athletes assignments like, how can you start building your business right now during the week? And that'll sharpen the edges as well. So those are a couple things, just the daily habits and then some experiments people can do to sharpen themselves. And it's usually I'll ask athletes, well, what is it that you want to do? What scares you? And let's make a plan for you to start doing
that. It sounds a lot like, you know, your organization, right? Organizing, but then there's this task orientation of like controlling those controllables, right? There's obviously a lot of benefits to doing a gratitude exercise. I typically do that, right after I get home before I eat. That's kind of my methodology kind of behind that. And that gratitude, right, provides you just a grounding tool of the things that you've done, you've accomplished, the things that you're thankful for. So you can continue to move forward and springboard. But a lot of the task orientation, what you're talking about is, I love the non-negotiable aspect of it, of this is just something that I do. This is something that's really going to ground me. But when you do things consistently without, you know, an excuse or a way to kind of get yourself out of it, it becomes a staple and it's something that you can structure yourself around. And again, those could be anchoring points for you when things are difficult or challenging that you just know you have them. And even if you're not going 100% mentally into that space, which would be ideal, right? At least you have them to kind of ground you back and get you back in track faster. So I love that kind of ability to task orient, but having it in a non-negotiable state.
Yeah, it's lately I've been talking quite a bit about identity with athletes and also on social media. I've just been thinking about it myself of the phrase is, I'm the kind of person who, or I'm the kind of athlete who, fill in the blank, so that you make it part of your identity. I'm the kind of athlete who gets up at 5 a.m. and does 20 minutes of stretching before working out. I'm the kind of athlete who doesn't drink alcohol during the week. And so that you repeat this mantra, it's almost like a positive brainwashing, where you tie these habits into your actual identity. So it's not like, oh, do I have to journal? Do I have to skip my beer during the week? It's like, no, I'm the kind of person who does that. So that it's like breaking that habit, then you're breaking your identity. And that is a thing that's much more stable, is identity as opposed to habits that you incorporate. So I like working on the identity aspect.
There's a book that I regularly recommend to high-level individuals. It's called The Book of the Five Rings. It's written by a 16th century samurai. So it's his kind of final memoir. He's somebody who was in multiple one-on-one individual combats. He was in three major battles. And he's talking really from a very Eastern philosophy style and talks from the kind of the perspective of a warrior, but kind of everything in which he does from ceremonial tea, a specific art of, I'm forgetting the name right now, but it's a specific art of acting that they do in Japan. And so everything is with a purpose, but he always talks about to examine it more thoroughly. So throughout the book, he's talking about becoming this. And when you are a warrior, everything in which you do needs to be with that mindset. It cannot differ. It cannot change. Because you just need to be constantly in that zone, in that space as a warrior. And, you know, when I hear what you're kind of communicating is, you're activating this mindset to kind of constantly be detail oriented, to be task engaged, to not necessarily give yourself the leeway to move away from your goal orientation, and then to take risks. Because if you're taking risks in the practice field, you're more likely to be creative and take risks maybe when in the midst of performance. And that's going to empower you that you know you can do it and be a successful or adapt when that happens. So there's a lot of kind of conversations around that. And it's a really a great kind of book. It's a little abstract at times, but it's a good book, The Book of the Five Rings, of information of how you can be more just aligned as a high performer constantly, right? You don't want to have to flip a switch, right? I like to say it's more of a turning a dial, right? We can dial it up, we can dial it down, because turning a switch just becomes more of this all or nothing, where a dial is you're ramping it up more.
Yeah, I like that analogy of the dial versus the switch, because the switch is like Jekyll and Hyde, right? Like that would be like this referring to Steve Young earlier. He's a total basket case before the football game, but then he flips the switch and he can get into it. Whereas if he had more of a dial, he could be like, oh, I'm feeling anxiety. Let me use my tools to dial that back. I know, because there's athletes who get like super nervous before competitions, and there's other athletes who are not activated enough, and they need to kind of amp themselves up. Knowing how that works for you is really important. I'm going to check out, I wrote this down, the Book of the Five Rings. So like the rituals and all these things of a warrior. So for an athlete, right? What are the routines and rituals that you need to do?
It's really interesting because he'll talk about like, he'll also go into like battle kind of stances of like using the environment to your advantage. So like always have the sun to your back when you're fighting, so the sun can be in the eyes of your opponent. Like it talks about how, knowing your opponent, you kind of talked about once you got to know some of the other athletes you were competing against, you recognize them as people. And a lot of times athletes who are competing at a very high level, they can perceive their own maybe anxieties or insecurities in those moments, but they're not always recognizing that the other person is feeling the same. I work with a lot of baseball pitchers and, they're trying to control the tempo of the game. They're thinking about that control and not messing up and hitting but the batter's also feeling that. And actually the pitcher 7 out of 10 times has the advantage compared to 3 out of 10 of the batter. And so it's really understanding it. It said, your opponent, by knowing it and by kind of putting yourself in their position, they can also feel afraid just as much as you. And but the book really calls the opponent the pheasant, and you're the hawk, and you're there to kind of attack the pheasant. And so I find it as an interesting, again, it's just a methodology and mindset that's different that could be helpful for athletes to think about.
That's really cool. A quick aside story from Milwaukee Brewers. You got me thinking about baseball. So I saw Reggie Jackson play back in the day against the Brewers, and it was really cool to watch. And he had this there's this interview where he talks about every time he steps up to the plate, he says it's a war between me and the pitcher. He focuses all of his he could focus on anxiety or himself, like I have to hit this, but he focuses on I want to destroy the pitcher. So he'll stare down the pitcher. He'll even kind of walk up slow, just mess with him. And he turns it all outward against the pitcher. And I didn't know that at the time when I watched the Brewers play the Yankees. But now I get it. And just kind of the way he played in that particular game. So yeah, it's like the hawk versus the pheasant, right? You got to think about your opponent as the pheasant. Right.
Absolutely.
So much of that too is ownership of, the batter's box, that accountability, Michael, that you were speaking earlier of, and just mindset wise of what is a clearer path for a lot of performers. And again, I'm listening to both of you talk, and you're kind of going back and forth, and there's more of this information exchange, and it's really about, it's a mindset, but it also, it has such a deliberateness to it. And it's one of the things that we emphasize to engage with deliberate intention, to do things on purpose. And I think one of the hurdles that so many athletes, so many performers have is the notion in their mind that it's now time to practice, that it's now time to practice. Well, really what you and Hunter are kind of going back and forth on, it's really a lifestyle. It's really an approach. It's a discipline that's beginning from the moment in which you wake up to when you have your opponent, you make sure that your back is always to the sun. It's the dial approach of always on with varying levels of intensity. But my step back question to that is, for those that are listening, is what features, what attributes, what practices that will just pull under the blanket of discipline for the purpose of this conversation, do we really look for that can help us with that always on mentality? So it's not such of a, it's now time to do this, because when we know that we're putting ourselves in those compartmentalized moments, we're not going to be as effective when we need to, because we're not accounting for the intensity or the emotional variables of those greater moments. And that's really for, that's for both of you.
Yeah, well, I got an idea on that. This kind of counter to what you're saying, I think you need to actually plan out your rest days in recovery, so that you don't hit the burnout. So if the modality is always on, but being able to adjust the intensity of the onness, right? That's important, and you can do that day by day. And at the same time, you need to bring the car to the shop from time to time too. So I think the starting point, actually counterintuitively here, is having scheduled recovery and rest, so that that's right in your plan and your schedule. And then on the 6 out of 7 days, you are on, and you're able to modulate that. So the disciplines during those on days would be really big on peer groups and having like-minded individuals in your life, so that basically you're going to feed off of each other. So it becomes less of an internal discipline and more of like, oh, you know, look what Hunter's doing today. Like, I got to make sure that I'm doing the same thing. So it's positive peer pressure. So that's a big context for athletes that I work with, is like, get around like-minded people. And then for the daily sharpening stuff, frankly, I like watching David Goggins. I don't know if you ever watched his videos, but he's pretty popular now. Just some like pump up stuff like that on a daily basis can get that fire and that sort of killer mindset activated. So a healthy diet of like some positive social media stuff, and then getting rid of the garbage social media too, is not necessarily a discipline, but it's like cleaning things out, making sure you have control over that dial. A couple other things too that I was working on a little while ago. I don't do it as much anymore, but breath holding is an interesting thing. Are you familiar with Wim Hof?
Yep, we're familiar.
Yeah, yeah. So for the listeners who don't know, it's Wim, W-I-M, Hof, H-O-F-F. He does this advanced breath holding, and I'm not a doctor. I'm not prescribing this, right? But it's I was playing around with it myself in terms of a mental toughness and that discipline with the on dial. And I was able to hold my breath for a really long time. And it was super interesting. And it just kind of like punched me into this new zone. Another thing I like to do is like cold plunges and just cold showers. Yep. Every morning before a podcast.
Yeah, Lee's going to join you on that one. Yeah.
Yeah, that is the thing where you're just forced into this zone, and then you get adjusted. Like, oh wow, cold showers feel good. So there's a lot of things you can do. So to summarize, I would say make sure you have your recovery scheduled, get in a really high performing peer group, and then have some daily rituals and routines that are going to keep you sharp, like the cold or whatever it is. Yeah.
I did some training at the Olympic Training Center, and so they kind of mixed it in with education, because it was more when I was a college athlete, and so they were mixing education with training and kind of that balance. And trainers would come in and say, you know, if you want to get to the Olympic level, if you want to be at an elite level, the number one thing that is going to separate you from any other player and athlete is your ability to recover. Because if you and another individual are at the exact same physical levels and gifts, realistically, you're going to be doing very similar things in terms of training. But if you get recovery and you're just at 100% every single day, the separation that slowly occurs incrementally over time, because you're always 100% ready to go, becomes just that much more. And so it's allowing you to separate and recover. And just kind of hearing you talk, it's almost like if I looked at my week schedule, I'm going to plug in my recovery days first or recovery times first, and then I'm going to look at what my performance schedule should be surrounding my recovery more so than anything. And I think that would be such a flip of script for somebody to think about, how somebody is planning their day or their week, their training schedule around proper recovery, right? Because again, the performance, the training, that's going to happen. Right. If you're a high performer, you're going to be engaging in those things, and different things are going to be able to establish that. But not every person is engaging that recovery, or I don't have enough time. Or, you know, if I'm going to a workout, typically most people are running out while everybody else is maybe stretching. So maybe there's 3 or 4 people in the group of 10 that stay to actually stretch after a circuit workout. If you've ever been a part of those, people are running to their job, right? If you're going to the 5 a.m. classes like I do, right? Everybody's running to work, right? But they're not taking just a few extra minutes to recover. So I think that's a really big piece. And I like what you're saying of making that higher priority, because it really is a differentiator and separator for you. And yeah, I agree that you need to feed yourself, you know, just like you would feed your body with positive nutrition, that mental nutrition that you need to make sure you're engaging with. So if you want to be someone who's motivated, engage yourself in motivational kind of conversations, podcasts, books, right? Those type of things that are going to feed you. Don't completely just disconnect from the things that you're trying to. Try to feed it with that positivity. And if you like it, great. If it's something that you're not necessarily aligned with, try to find an alternative, right, that maybe is a little bit more digestible for you. So I think you're right in terms of just trying to find modalities and mediums, because now there's a lot. There's a lot of things out there, more resources than ever before for individuals to engage with and achieve their high performance. And lastly, really kind of talking about, you said, you know, having different levels to that, right? Always being on. And always being on isn't necessarily just a physical, right? This is always being on from that mental, or it's from that recovery standpoint. So it doesn't just have to be always on. Doesn't mean you're running, you know, wind sprints up a mountain with, you know, a 20-pound, you know, weighted vest. It can be always on is just more so the deliberateness, as Lee was talking about, having deliberateness and intentionality with the things that you're doing. Right. You're just being, there's purpose behind, from, you know, taking it slow and eating digestive, you know, to digest it more effectively, to words and conversations. Sometimes, as, you know, trainers, we have to be very mindful of the words in which we say and how that affects an individual and the way in which that message is taken. So you have to be very deliberate with every single word that you're trying to speak. Right. So that can be a part of it, whether it's media training for an athlete, right, or conversations with coaches, difficult conversations with coaches. There's more deliberateness in everything in which you do. So that's what it's really, I think, that always on mentality is more so just being deliberate more often, having goals that are associated with it. And then obviously that deliberate recovery as part of that process.
That's a great word, deliberate. So oftentimes recovery is seen as, I'm resting too much, or I'm going on defense. It's like, no, that is a deliberate action on my part so that I can fill my tank and attack even more. So I love that word, deliberate.
That's a recharge. Recovery is recharge, right? It's, you can have, what is it, the iPhone 14 now? So you can have the iPhone 24, the best technology 10 years down the road, but if it has zero charge, it doesn't matter, right? It's just that, you know, probably a glorified paperweight. So making sure that you can recharge allows you to access your full capacity on a daily basis, which is maximizing the quality, not the quantity of the reps that and what you're doing.
Yeah, makes sense. Absolutely.
Michael, tell us more just about your work and some of the more interesting projects that you feel that, you know, are just relevant to our own head game today.
Yeah. So in my, you know, I do two things. I do psychotherapy with general population, also with athletes, and then I do more of the coaching to the next level. So projects, I really wanted to get some group coaching starting. So I'm just starting that aspect and just really realizing the power of a peer group, like a really, well-picked peer group. So the group coaching is what I'm getting into. I'm also wanting to work with some more baseball teams. That's an early passion of mine from Little League, and just getting that team culture going, the team spirit, strengthening the leaders of teams. And that's another thing I've been really thinking about too, is just the power that a leader has, the responsibility that a leader has, and how is there's a lot of coaches who haven't quite mastered that leadership aspect of always being positive. You can be a hard ass. It doesn't matter. You can be like a Bobby Knight or something, but you still got to be a strong leader and you got to be fair and set a good example. So the things I'm working on is like leadership training and group coaching. Those are the two things that are on my plate that I'm trying to develop. There's also a book coming out pretty soon, still working on it. And it the working title is called Make the Break, not quite Breaking Away, but Make the Break. And a quick story on that. That was like basically the big moment in my cycling career when I created my first breakaway, where I actually finally went on the attack. And that was when I realized that I could compete against like the best. And I decided to be audacious and form my own breakaway. So that, anyway, those are some things I'm working on. I love what I do. I love talking to guys like you who are like-minded. This is a great conversation. I think people are going to get a lot out of this episode. And it's just so many important topics that we're talking about today.
Michael, as you sit down to write your book, tell us more about some of your own professional challenges, because I think we get to a stage in our career and we feel, you know, people have been telling us, hopefully for a while, hey, that's a pretty good point, or, you know, you should write a book, or you should share that message. But very few people take it to the next level. They don't hang on there long enough to see what's beyond the horizon line, mm-hmm. or just have a more of a variable stick-to-itiveness where it comes to writing or the process. Talk to us a little bit more about your own journey in writing a book, when you first came up with the idea and what it's been like.
Yeah, you know, it's funny, like in any career or even any like relationship or whatever, there's these things, there's these fears of kind of leveling up. So the part of it is like, oh, who am I to write a book, right? I have to have a PhD, or I have to have, like, you know, some endorsement by like Tony Robbins or something like that. Well, that'd be nice, actually. But feeling you have to be perfect, you have to be quote unquote ready to do something. And the way, you know, interesting thing about that is kind of like an ego trip of like, who am I to share something? It's like, well, who are you not to share? Like, why would you withhold something that's been so helpful for you and other people? Wouldn't you want to share that more? So that can kind of get you out of that zone of fear of leveling up or fear of failure. It's like more of like, I can actually add to the conversation. I can make the world a better place by sharing something. And if it's, no one reads it, you know, who cares? Nothing lost, right? But it's more of like, why don't I focus more on helping people as opposed to me having a book that's going to be successful? It's like, why don't, and the same goes for coaching too, like, why don't I, or even being an athlete, why don't I be successful as an athlete to create a ripple effect? I talked about this recently on one of my social medias, the ripple effect. If you inspire as an athlete or as a coach or as a human being, you do something that's challenging or scary, that's going to have a ripple effect around people around you. They're like, oh, look what he's doing. Like, that's interesting. Maybe I want to do that, right? And then those other people do it and people around them go, oh, look what he or she did. Like, I want to do that. So it creates this positive ripple. So for me, I tried to push myself in writing this book and just thinking about it in that respect, like this could possibly help people. And I want to do it. And the book is basically, it's about the mentors, the default coaches that I've had in my life that I never asked for, that just sort of came into my life and have said some magic words. So the book is all about quotes and magic words that basically were had a big impact on me.
Sounds very interesting. Definitely have to pick it up.
I think that's, you know, inspiring stuff, because again, what I love, Michael, is that you're putting yourself out there, right, as a writer. But you're making it so incredibly personal. You're not afraid to tell your own story, to provide relevant reasons why. I so often say the role of mental performance coach, psychologist, is to model as best we can the very things that we're asking our clients to do. And Ripple Effect, by the way, is another great name for a book. I'm just saying, I'm just throwing it out there. I don't know if you consider that
book number
maybe
two.
That's part two. You do a three book, you know, trilogy. But that's a great title as well. But I love how you're recognizing that you want to help others by providing them through modeling with a safe example for them to digest your intel at the pace, at the intensity that they prefer. And as it translates to the high-performing mindset, so often we want things yesterday. Again, I'll go back to social media. I'll go back to the pressures of the modern-day athlete. It's not fair of me to say. More often, it feels like people struggle with patience, mm-hmm. and having something to say or something to do, but recognizing that it's going to take time. And working on things like pushing through obstacles and relevant mental fatigue. So you're inspiring me to a degree. I've dabbled with the idea of a book, And I'm sure that, you know, we could, if we were to create our top 10 lists prior to you beginning the process, 7 or 10 of them are probably the exact same as to really good reasons why you don't have the time to do it. Or who am I to suggest that I can communicate something of value to other people? It's all of those common human frailties, those intangible characteristics that aside from the book, aside from the message, the effort unto itself is so valuable. So for that, Michael, I commend you.
Well, thank you. Yeah, it really just makes me think about, so there's a quote from Marianne Williamson. This is something I want to share here. Maybe it's a good thing to end on here. It's she basically says, so she's an author. She's wrote a couple of really cool books. And I learned this in a yoga class where they were doing like a meditation at the end. And they read this quote by Marianne Williamson. And it was just along these lines of like, who are you to attempt to be brilliant and expand yourself? And then she says, well, who are you not? Like you playing small, you playing it safe, playing it small serves nobody, right? The world needs your gifts and everybody has a gift and everybody should share that gift in some respect and it makes the world a better place. So
I love that quote. I think about, you know, the bowler, the Duke, who, you know, he has the kind of the famous like video of like, who do you think I am? Like, have you ever seen that? So he like bowls a strike, wins the game.
No.
And he's just an enthusiastic, light up individual. And he says, who do you think I am? You know, and it's just like, you know, who do you think you are? I am is the quote. So it's like, who do you think you are? I am, like, I'm the guy. So it's kind of probably spur of the moment. But I think it's backing what you're saying there is like, yeah, who are you not to be that person? And that's an exciting proposition to always ask yourself to try to be the person that you want to be, that idealized person that, you know, Lee was talking about, like, who are you not to be that person? I think a lot of people say like, why I'm not that person versus, yeah, who am I not to be that person? Why not?
I know you have your own business, your own website. You know, how do we get a hold of you? How do people find you? Tell us a little bit about, you know, the best way to contact you and what that's about.
Yeah. So my last name is a pretty unique spelling. So if you just Google my name, everything comes up. You'll see my psychotherapy website. You'll see my sports psychology website, Instagram, all that stuff. So Michael, first names, last name is spelled C-E-E-L-Y. That's it.
Okay. Thanks so much, Michael.
Well, thank you. Thanks for taking the time to be a guest on the Head Game, where we have to at times provide some examples for our listening audiences to peer into the high performing mind and the things that they think about and the decisions they make because of that. So thank you so much for being a great guest, a shining example, and we wish you all the best.
Thanks for having me on the Head Game podcast. It's been a great discussion, guys.